So for the people that listen to the hip-hop show, I'm sure you all know of what has happened the past week involving an iconic musician, really. Not even really a hip-hop guy, as people say. An overall musician in DMX. And before we get going with the retrospective, I just want to say that social media can be a bitch. And social media can take things and just go to entitlement. And all the rhetoric about him with the vaccine, him taking it, him not taking it, him dying from it or not dying from it, he has had a hard past internally for him. And regardless of any of that, regardless of any of his health issues, let's just put that to the side, please, for a moment, and just talk about the career. Let's talk about his legacy. Let's talk about what he meant to hip-hop. Let's talk about a guy who in 97 went his own lane while Puff Daddy and Mace and Bad Boy was going all nuts with their, I'm not even going to give an adjective, but you know the Puff Daddy Bad Boy movement of 97. He went his own lane. He went a totally different route. And he stayed in that lane. And he never diverted from that lane. And here we are celebrating his career now. And that's what we need to focus in on. Not on him getting his family getting not his lawyer, for example, not revealing to his family his passing. That's irrelevant right now. We need to talk about the career of this amazing man, amazing musician, DMX. And I figure, as Sky Cameron, of course, is here, we can't have a hip-hop anything without Sky Cameron. So he's going to have all the stats. We're going to go through the life of him. We're going to go through the origin story. We're going to go through the albums. And polarizing character, polarizing human being, to say the least. Sky, what's your thoughts initially here?
Yeah, to say Earl Simmons lived a tough life is a definite understatement, you know? He was born December 18, 1970 in Mount Vernon, New York. He was raised in the city of Yonkers by his single mother when his father left when he was born. And Earl just suffered as a child from bronchial asthma and even got hit by a drunk driver when he was a little kid. His mother refused to take the settlement money due to their strict Jehovah's Witness beliefs, which conflicted his views on religion. He suffered beatings from not only his mother, but various abusive boyfriends that she dated throughout his childhood. And by the time he was 14, Earl was wandering the streets at night, befriending stray dogs in the neighborhood. He said he always preferred the company of dogs to people. He was then sent to a boys' home at 15, where he started writing raps with kids that he met in the boys' home, and chose the name DMX, or Dark Man X, after the Oberheim DMX drum machine that they had in the boys' home. After going to prison in 1988 for carjacking, where he there spent time in jail with fellow MC K-Solo, he began rapping and writing lyrics more seriously. When he was released, he linked with Rough Riders founders Wah and D, and recorded the demo tape that got him featured in Matty C's source column Unsigned Hype in 1991 as DMX the Great. He was signed to Rough How Columbia Records in 1992, and his first official single was Born Loser. This is not available on streaming platforms, but if you guys want to check out his original Born Loser demo, check it out on YouTube.
I have this on tape, by the way.
You had a cassette?
I'm recalling I have a cassette.
It was a promo single, I believe.
Yeah.
So after this single failed to connect with a wider audience, he split from Rough House and would resurface in 1994 with independently released single Make a Move, which was produced by a guy named DJ Irv, who we know now as Irv Gotti. This bond formed with Irv also got DMX featured on an underground posse cut called Time to Build with up-and-coming rappers Ja Rule, Jay-Z, and Mike Geronimo. This song was featured on the 95 debut album The Natural. DMX then became a part of an original rap group called Murder Inc., which featured Ja Rule, himself, Jay-Z, and Irv Gotti. That was the original Murder Inc., guys. Irv Gotti then became an A&R at Def Jam in the mid-90s, which got DMX an audition with the head of Def Jam, Lior Cohen, at the time. X wrapped his audition verse to Lior in the studio with his jaw wired shut since it was broken from a fight. Lior was so blown away, they signed him on the spot. And then between 1996 and 1998, while DMX was recording his debut album, he made memorable appearances on tracks such as Money, Power, and Respect from The Lox, 24 Hours to Live by Mace, The Posse Cut 4321 by LL Cool J, Shut 'Em Down by Onyx, and What You Gonna Do by Jail Felony. All of these tracks released built up the hype and excitement for X's debut album, It's Dark and Hell is Hot, which was released May 12, 1998 on Rough Rider Def Jam Records. DMX would go on to release 5 consecutive number one albums on Billboard's pop and rap album charts between 1998 and 2003. He remains one of the only hip-hop artists to ever accomplish this feat. Jay-Z, Eminem, Kanye West, Drake are the only other artists to ever achieve this. DMX is currently ranked number 10 in the best-selling hip-hop artists of all time. Aaron, what's your earliest memory of DMX?
So you brought up a lot of singles that I just... comes to mind now.
Yeah.
That before his album dropped were major stuff.
Yeah.
And it was really great. It was like the Jail Felony song. Very underrated song. You can play that one?
Oh, yeah. Let's play it.
Because that one, 4321, was classic.
Yeah.
So I'm following along here as you're reading off here. Money, Power, Respect is classic. Right. I mean, what am I saying? All of them are just
he was considered
automatic.
The saving grace of Def Jam, and that's why
right.
You notice that What You Gonna Do, Jail Felony, 4321.
Yeah.
These are all Def Jam artists.
Right.
Shut 'Em Down, Onyx. These are all Def Jam artists.
Right.
So Lior's like, throw him on everything.
Right. So that was the thing with him. Because you're right, he saved Def Jam. Because where was Def Jam at with Bad Boy doing what they're doing? Right, Death Row doing what they were doing.
Right.
The savior.
I'm glad you said that because it was DMX and Jay-Z's distribution deals with Rough Riders and Rockefeller that kept the lights on at Def Jam.
Yeah.
You know, it was a really intense time financially for Def Jam in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they were actually going up against powerhouse independent labels like No Limit Records and Cash Money at
yeah.
the time. So, you know, in a unprecedented move, basically Lior asked DMX and Rough Riders to produce another album in the same year. So
right.
DMX released his follow-up sophomore album, Flesh of My Flesh, Blood of My Blood, on December 22nd, 1998. No other musical artists, not just hip-hop, have ever released back-to-back number one Billboard pop albums in the same year.
Yeah. Trippy,
yep.
to say the least. Because, well, for myself, okay, you're a little bit older than me.
Right.
This was after high school. So after high school hit, 97, 98, 99 was a very odd transition for a hip-hop fan,
right.
I guess, because you had the internet in its infancy getting stronger, and then all of these New York rappers and all the guys that we liked in 94, 95, they kind of were vanishing because Puff Daddy was so huge.
Right.
The Bad Boy, like hip-hop was the most commercial it ever got. So like, wow, this is like pop now. So we couldn't find anything to listen to. So then you had this guy, you had Bad Boy, you had the No Limit guys, and then you had all the skaters like in Company Flow. That's your John. Everybody split.
Mm-hmm.
The fans split off into their own worlds. And for this guy to come out with 2 albums, I still remember, like, never happened before, but it was just strange that when that happened, I knew everything has changed and we can't go back. We're not going to go back to the way hip-hop was. It's now, it's evolved. It grew out of itself. Because now it's just the machine that is hip-hop. It is not the fun, let's go buy some magazines and look
this
at the source.
This is masculine hip-hop.
This is off we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like the butterfly out of another cocoon. So that was my initial thoughts of this guy.
And he was polarizing to hip-hop fans.
Oh, yeah.
In your experience.
Yeah. Hawaii people didn't like him. I'm going to say that right now.
Hawaii people, specifically in the
Hawaii hip-hop
scene. Right. That you were embedded
right.
in. This is DJs. We're talking about DJs, hip-hop artists,
people
hip-hop
you
fans
know.
That you knew.
You just know them from around the town.
Right.
And it was the skaters, the skateboarding crowd. They were all into Tribe Called Quest. They were all into Hieroglyphics. They were all into Gangstar. This guy not really fits the mold of any of those guys. Maybe Gangstar. But they liked N.W.A. They liked West Coast stuff, but it wasn't mainstream. They didn't like the mainstream. That was always a thing. They didn't like the Dr. Dre. They didn't like the Tupac. DMX was a mainstream guy. Of course, they're not going to like Bad Boy. So he fell into that realm because he got so popular so quickly. And then he's masculine. Skaters, they're masculine, but they're a different kind of masculine.
Right.
Didn't resonate to a lot of people.
Wow.
People didn't relate to him.
Right.
And that was the disconnect. And that was why a lot of people didn't dig him. They just thought it was just some kind of a tough guy, fake, comes to mind, because they don't know the story of the right. guy. We don't have the internet to go be searching all this shit.
Right.
So that was the story of Hawaii. You were playing DMX in the club, of course, but you're playing it to like a mainstream crowd.
Right.
You're playing it at the Blue Zebra. You're playing it at the World Cafe. You're not going to be playing it at like some hip-hop event at like Liquid Surf Den. Or, you know, some kind of a thing that's going to have freestyling.
Right.
Ain't nobody playing DMX if there's going to be a freestyle cypher going on. That'll be like sacrilegious.
No, he was like, not. We can't have that. He was not like a lyrical guy, but he was like another evolution of a late 90s Onyx. Right? It was yes. hard. It was like intense.
Yes.
And then the beats were kind of polarizing at the time because they weren't the 808 beats. And
right.
Swiss Beats, Dame Grease, and PK, the Rough Riders production crew, they were not using a lot of samples.
No.
They were all synthesizers.
That's how another reason why hip hop changed. The samples that we all know, nope, just simple. And just to clarify here, Hawaii people do love DMX. DMX had a big following, just not the hip-hopper.
The Bradas love them.
Yes, yes.
And I guess my experience was different because I didn't have the hip-hop crew that you had.
Yeah.
So I was working at Long's Drugs at the time,
yeah.
and I was hanging out with the Bradas,
yeah.
and they loved it. And
of course.
So, of
totally
course,
agree.
I got sucked into that, and I was a fan. I was a fan,
yes.
you know, just from being, you know, associated with that group, but I also was a fan from his earlier features.
Right.
I want to just mention one song. It was actually one of the bonus tracks on the end of Ja Rule's Vinny Vidi Vici album. It was called It's Murda. You remember the
yeah.
song? And it was the original Murda
yeah.
Inc. crew. It's Ja Rule, Jay-Z, and DMX.
Yeah.
And I just thought DMX was just like... hard, man.
Well, he has a menacing voice. His
yeah.
presence, the persona, of
right.
course, we get it. We all get it. It's either, how do I put this? If you're a guy...
The growling. We never heard this growling in the barks.
No growling, right.
Right.
Because, we go back to Onyx. Onyx, either you liked them or you didn't. Onyx became popular. They became popular for yelling.
Right.
They became popular for a gravelly voice.
Right.
And if you're a skater... Listening to Del the Funky Homo Sapien,
right.
you're not gonna like Onyx. You're gonna be like, what the fuck is this?
Right.
This sounds mainstream. This just sounds lame. So the evolution of Onyx is him. You're not gonna think otherwise. It's not gonna change your mind. So it's a little bit of a closed-mindedness.
Right.
Because of the it's like a wine connoisseur or like a sushi connoisseur. What do you call it? Snob.
Right.
Cocktail snob.
Right.
It's a hip-hop snob.
Mm.
So they're not gonna wanna veer into that, even though it's different than Bad Boy, but it's just because it's mainstream.
Yeah, they want to listen to Aesop Rock or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
So then you had that split. Because hip-hop guys, if you're a hip-hop guy in 94 and you met another hip-hop guy, you're going to like the same stuff.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be like, oh, you know this guy, you know this group, you know this group? Because there's only a few of us, right?
These guys are listening to Rascal and Peanut Butter Wolf.
Right. It all divided. It split everything. That's why I always go back. 97, we do a 97 show.
Right.
My God. Because that's the change of everything. Everything changed.
DMX was the top guy for the East Coast at this point. Remember, in the food chain of rap, he was bigger than Jay-Z at this point.
Yes, he was. He was the guy.
Because Jay-Z had not released In My Life Volume 1 and 2 yet.
Right.
He was following DMX.
Right.
And Jay-Z would ultimately, you know, have the most number one albums, you know, 11 in a row, but DMX kind of paved the way.
He paved the way, but evolution-wise, Jay-Z surpassed. Because Jay-Z, of course, variety-wise, Jay-Z changes with the times and evolves with the times.
Right.
DMX never changed with the times. He just always stuck to his lane, which is
right.
very great integrity-wise.
Right.
But that's how it is. So then you look at New York. Okay, so you talk about New York and how he saved New York and how he's like the guy, the top guy in New York. who was really the top guys in New York in 1998, right? If you're going to not count Bad Boy, because Bad Boy's obviously from New York. But if you're not going to count them, it's going to be Jay-Z. You could count, what, Ja Rule? Just being East Coast?
Right.
You could count that. And then you got this guy. And then that's it. And then what, the Lox? The Lox is Bad Boy.
You can't count them. You're going up against the South and the West Coast.
Exactly. Yeah. Things branched out. You have the South. You have Georgia. You have Texas. You have California. So everything changed.
Yeah.
And he had a lot to do with it. He had a major part to do with it of what happened to hip-hop in the late 90s, because it changed a lot.
It did. The debut album would go on to sell 251,000 copies in its first week and would go four times platinum, selling 4.8 million copies. The Source ranked it number four in their top 10 albums of 1998 under Jay-Z's In My Lifetime Volume 2 and Outkast's Aquemini.
Okay.
It received four mics at the time.
Okay.
And the singles, we all remember the singles. It was Get At Me Dog, How's It Going Down, and the most recognizable among the mainstream DMX fans, Rough Riders Anthem.
Right.
Which I want to just point out was produced by 16-year-old Swiss Beatz.
Yeah.
At the time. 16 years old.
Yeah.
With a Casio keyboard.
Yeah. Incredible. Incredible. And he set the tone too. Let's talk about Swiss Beatz for a moment.
Yes.
He set the tone for.
There is no
changing.
DMX without Swiss Beatz.
No.
There is no Swiss Beatz without DMX.
Correct. That's it. That's clearly it. And it's kind of, I don't want to say it's sad, but it's just kind of polarizing how this guy in 98, because he dominated 98, changed everything.
Right.
It just changed everything. Like, if this didn't happen, if the Bad Boy DMX thing didn't happen, I don't know where hip-hop would be. I really don't know where it would go.
He headlined the DJ Clue mixtape, The Professional.
Right.
He was the East Coast's saving grace with DMX, with Jay-Z.
Because you look at the vibe of these songs. Now, we're doing a 94 show, right?
Right.
And we're talking about the vibe of 94.
Right.
Totally, clearly different now in 97,
yeah.
And how it just evolved. So it alienated a lot of people, because people still wanted Tribe Called Quest sounding beats.
Right.
But then Puffy came in and then said, fuck it, I'm just going to go sample things, catchy songs, and then off they went. And then you have this guy who's doing really simplified beats with Swiss Beatz, Rough, Onyx 2.0.
Yep.
And that was your two types of hip-hop you had as a guy that's 18... 17 in 98. Then what do you do after that? You go up, jump on the Company Flow bandwagon. You go look up Rockus Records. And you got those guys. And then you got the white boy rap thing coming up with Eminem and all them. You got the independent rap. It's a polarizing time that he dominated in. For people that weren't a part of this in 98, I'm just trying to emphasize the point. It was a very polarizing year, much like him.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
The second album, Flesh of My Flesh, Blood of My Blood, would be even a bigger album, selling 670,000 copies in its first week, breaking all sales records for a solo rap artist at that time. I think Snoop Dogg, Doggy Style, and that album were the biggest selling, I think, at that point in its first week sales. That album will go three times platinum, selling 3.5 million copies.
Wow.
And then this also, Flesh of My Flesh, made The Source's top 10 albums as well.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well,
the critics were loving him. So do you put in your, like, just your personal perspective on things and your personal taste in hip hop? I'm guessing I already know the answer to this question, but do you feel a lot of hip hop fans, East Coast fans, they considered both of these albums back-to-back classics, the debut and the sophomore. Do you feel like they're classics in their own right? Or do you feel they're not for you? You can understand why they are, but they're not for you?
If I go back to 1998,
right.
What was I doing? What was I thinking? I was already DJing.
Right.
So I moved into that realm. I found the independent scene with Rockus Records and all those guys and Fondalum and all that independent stuff. So you had that. You had the Eminem music. You had him. I got it. I understood it. I understood where he was coming from. I understood the magnitude of this guy. I understood the popularity of this guy. It tripped me out back then that a guy that was this gravelly and yelling was so major.
Right.
So it just made me think of the audience. What is the audience buying this? Is it people that just want like hype music? Is it people that just want hype music to play in the car? Hype music to work out in? What's the female demographic of women that like this? You know, do they like it because he's a masculine guy? He's not ugly, so do they like him because he's a good-looking guy and he's muscular and all that? So I'm just thinking like the fan base is just so eclectic. That's why he's selling 600-some thousand in the first week.
I think he had the similar appeal to Tupac, where people just felt he was real. They felt exactly, he was genuine.
Right. And I think that's what happened, because with Tupac passing, this was their guy that they gravitated towards, and it led to that. If you're a hip-hop guy, though, were you a fan of Tupac? A lot of them weren't.
Yep.
They just didn't dig it.
Right.
If you're a Souls of Mischief guy, are you getting into some tough guy with tattoos all over himself, shirtless? I don't think so.
This is tough for me because I was a fan of both. I like both.
So I think, and that's what makes you interesting, very interesting in your, because you didn't have these influences around you. You were just this one guy that was listening to all of this stuff amazingly, with the world around you not listening to it really. You're hanging out with the brothers. So you didn't have that kind of influence coming towards you.
I wouldn't dare like play my Souls or my Extra Prolific with the brothers.
Well, you knew
that to myself.
Exactly.
But then this is the time I'm playing Redman, I'm playing DMX, exactly. I'm playing Jay-Z,
exactly.
Ja Rule.
I mean, that's what a DJ does.
Right.
You gotta know your lane of what your people are standing there listening to and like.
That's a perfect thing to segue in. So for you personally, they're not classics to you, but you can understand why they're classics.
I will say that they are classics. To me personally, if I was to talk to 1998 me, would I buy these albums? I would say no.
Okay.
I would be like, that's just not... Because I wasn't into Bad Boy. I got it, but I wasn't into excited about Bad Boy. But I got it. But I wouldn't necessarily spend money on it.
Right.
You know? So I respect it. But that's, if you looked at me now at 2021, I respect it a great deal. Would I listen to it now out of remembrance? Yes. But in 1998, it was a different vibe. It was a totally different vibe.
Wow.
And I had that with these influences on me. You did not have those influences, right. And you bought the album.
Right.
And so in essence, you're an enigma in yourself, because you didn't have these people telling you, or not telling you, but just like vibing off of you.
I definitely had influences around me, but I still was buying everything because I wanted to put into perspective what was happening in each region. And I always enjoyed watching the evolution of hip-hop in each territory. And I loved seeing how New Orleans evolved. And I loved seeing how Tennessee and Atlanta evolved. And I loved seeing how all these different pockets of the West Coast evolved. So
that's how it should have been. That's how it should be.
Yeah.
That's how hip-hop fans were before they became snobs. The hip-hop snob movement became a thing in 97.
Yeah.
And that was the downfall of... It was the downfall, but yet evolution of where things are now.
It was the rise of labels like Def Jux and Stone's Throw, and it did splinter hip-hop fans.
Yeah.
Because they were clamoring for less mainstream, more lyrical. I get it.
And then they wanted the beats from what they grew up on that gravitated to them the best, like Tribe Called Quest.
Right.
Illmatic, Pete Rock. They just love that shit, and they didn't want to let go of it. Once it finally started becoming not in, they were left lost. Onto Fondalum they went. Onto Ruckus they went. Because Ruckus was holding on. They were holding on to 94. They were holding on to 95 vibe, where DMX clearly was not.
This guy had an incredible run. I mean, he releases his third album, and then there was X, December 21st, 1999. Third consecutive album. His fourth album, The Great Depression, October 23rd, 2001. And then his fifth album, Grand Champ, on September 16th, 2003. He was consistent in getting albums out relatively quick.
Yeah. Very much so.
He had a run that most guys have never had and will never have.
Well, okay. This song is a 5-mic song, by the way. So this song, I want to say this for the record. So all of his singles, 4.5 to 5 mics. pretty much every single single that he released.
He had great A&R and people behind him picking out the songs
right.
and the beats for him, and they knew exactly the kind of song to release.
Exactly. They knew his lane. And speaking of his lane, you know how we talked about the last episode of how these guys, they come out sophomore slumps?
Right.
Because they're pressured by the record company to do this, or they had a hit first album, and then they don't know what to do. So then they see the Bad Boy, or they see Death Row is becoming a thing, so we have to be more gangster, or we have to be harder core. Lords of the Underground, we're going to lose our funniness and become serious. They fuck up. He never fucked up. He just stayed in the same yep. lane, and it worked.
Yep.
Again, he never diverted. And again, and again.
Even for him doing R&B songs.
It still works.
It still worked. Yeah.
Because he stayed in his lane.
Right.
It's not like, okay, DMX is singing now. DMX said the same thing with Aaliyah.
Right.
It perfectly matches because Aaliyah's going to sing.
Right.
He doesn't need to do anything but just be himself. And that's it.
And let's quickly mention his movie career. I mean, right. the guy starred in way more movies than a lot of people remember.
Yeah.
He starred in Belly.
Yeah.
Cradle to the Grave.
Yeah.
Exit Wounds. Never Die Alone. I mean, he had a run in films.
Yeah. Multi-talented, multifaceted guy. And I think this is a... This episode is kind of perfect to follow up from the sophomore slumps, because the formula, what do you do to continue to be successful in music?
Be true to yourself.
You be true to yourself, and you just stay in your lane. If you're the goofy rapper guy in 95, be the goofy rapper guy in 96. Just stay who you are, because if they liked you back then, they're going to like you now. They're not going to be like, oh, how come you don't sound like Dr. Dre? You should not care. Because you will never be Dr. Dre. There's no way. And Dr. Dre will never be you. So this is the perfect formula. This is the guy for any artist out there.
As a DJ, what DMX tracks did you enjoy watching a crowd react to when you're doing a set? What were your favorite songs to play that you knew that were going to get a reaction and you personally enjoyed?
Okay, that's a great question, because as a DJ... playing at hip-hop events or lounge-style events, DMX is not played. You don't play DMX. If you're at Brew Moon and it's like a intimate setting such as that, and you have majority of the audience is women, and it's just a loungy vibe, you're not going to play X Gonna Give It To You. You're not going to play Rough Riders Anthem. So it was very strange, because where I was playing, you don't play DMX. But if I was like DJing before BET, you play DMX. Or after BET stops performing at Don Ho's, you can play DMX. Obviously, the crowd. So it's strange like that. So DMX was not played a lot.
In your sense?
Not in my sense. It depends on the venue.
Yeah.
It depends on the mainstream crowd you have. Mm. If you're at some kind of race show, a car show, where they had DJs, and we DJed at the car shows at Blaisdell. Mainstream crowd, racers. What do? They like to race the speed bikes. The what do you call those things? Racer bikes? Moped? Not mopeds. I was gonna say mopeds. The bikes. The Kawasaki's. That shit.
Or like the Japanese import bikes.
I don't know why I can't think. Right. That were in the video Rough Riders Anthem. Right. So clearly, you're playing DMX in front of that crowd. And they're gonna get it. So it's not an easy answer for that. As far as the playing DMX when you're DJing in public. It depends.
This is probably the song I like the least, but it was probably the most girls rock out to this.
Of course. Of course.
This was like the sorority frat boy anthem.
Right. Major, major hit. Major, major.
Arguably his biggest song.
Clearly. Yes. I still think it's a classic. It's still a 5-mic song. For the impact that it, as soon as you hear the first 3 seconds, you're gonna know what the hell's going on, and it's gonna give you some kind of a feeling. What song does that in two, three seconds? Not many.
Yeah, they grabs you
immediately.
That really grabs you.
Like, and everybody knows this beginning. When you hear the beat come in, you're gonna know that song. If you play Who Dis with someone, they're gonna know that song.
Yeah,
100%.
In 3 seconds.
Correct.
Yeah.
So clearly, it's hit.
You didn't own any DMX albums. You had the singles.
Yeah.
If you had to listen to a DMX song yourself, what would be that song? even if it's not in his catalog and it's just a feature of his, what is the song that you would play? For
if it was featured, it would be...
It doesn't matter.
If it, well, first one's come to mind, 4-3-2-1.
Okay.
Fun one.
Right.
The Mary J. Blige Sincerity with Nas.
Let's play that.
That was just one not many people know.
That was on a that was a bonus CD off the Mary J. Mary album in 99.
Yeah.
So this wasn't even on the main album version. This was on a bonus CD, and it was like a bonus cut. I remember buying the double disc, and then this was on the double disc.
Exactly.
Right.
Hard to find. Not many people know it. But then you see how he's rhyming in this. He still has his gravelly voice. He doesn't need to yell. He knows what the vibe of what's going on is. But this is him. But he's not selling out here. He's not changing his style. It's still the same stock and same shit. That's how you stay in your lane, people. That's how you do it. And it works. And it perfectly matches this. And then you got married? I mean, come on. That's automatic. But then this song, 4-3-2-1, Jail Felony.
You like the early stuff.
The early stuff was always great. I mean, if I had to pick like a solo thing he did.
Yeah.
X Gonna Give It To You.
That's your number
that's
one.
That's a fun one.
Yeah.
That's a fun one. And it grows on you. After that, though, it's usually the featured songs. Get At Me Dog is cool.
Do you feel like this song that I'm playing, Sincerity from Mary J. Blige, do you feel like this is his most underrated verse?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. No one's going to talk about this. No one. That's why I posted this on the IG story. Because it's just... I don't think people are going to know the song, so I might as well play it. And it's a good song. Him doing the collaboration with Aaliyah. Yeah. The Back in One Piece.
Yep.
That was off a movie soundtrack.
That was off of, I think, Cradle to the Grave, if I'm not mistaken.
Excellent song. And he stayed in his lane.
Yeah.
He stayed to his formula. And that's all you got to do. And it works. So he had all of that stuff. Because then, okay, so there's another thing with to build your career that I've noticed through the decades here. Kanye did the same thing. As soon as you get an album out, be as featured on as many other people's songs as you can and just show up everywhere. That's what he did.
He was prolific.
You just show up and then you do your shit. People that like Aaliyah that don't know who DMX is, well, they're going to know him now. Simple formula. Be featured everywhere. And that's what he did. He was featured everywhere. Def Jam put him out right. They marketed him, put him out right. Even the Jail Felony song. People are not going to know what Jail Felony is or even give a damn. But they're going to know that song.
Yeah.
They're not going to know it was Jail Felony song. They're going to be like, oh, that's this guy, and then DMX is on it, and then this. Yeah,
Method Man.
They're not going to know. Def Jam was smart. And they pulled the trigger right on all of his maneuvers, on all of his strategic releases and whatnot. Well done.
We don't need to talk about his substance abuse and his struggle with drugs.
No.
You know, I think it was well documented. I think a lot of people knew he was struggling with it, but you know, it just a real tragic end to a guy that was such a huge figure in hip hop.
Yeah.
And he was beloved. I mean, he was beloved. And you know, I think his legacy will go on.
Oh, clearly, yeah. And that's pretty much what we're doing this show is basically covering the musical genius, I'm going to have to even say. It is.
Yeah.
It's a combination of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and just stay true to yourself and keep the integrity.
And a guy who really spilled his blood and heart and all on the tracks.
I mean,
he was... So he had the toughness, he had the vulnerability,
right?
And he was just as a polarizing figure as Tupac was, because he was violent, but at the same time he had his hardcore religious beliefs,
right?
And he was always in constant struggle with himself.
Oh yeah,
he had every album he had the Damien, a lot of the albums he had the Damien tracks where he was talking to himself in the other voice. Where it's the angel and the devil.
Yeah.
His conscience. So he was a tortured guy, you know, and I hope he's in a better place, and I hope he's not in pain anymore.
That's all we can hope for. I mean, these albums were therapeutic for him in a lot of ways. I think this was his therapy. Because he's unleashing all of his thoughts on all these albums. All the while, internally, he's going through a lot. Countless health issues, rehabilitation issues, being unresponsive at places, being resuscitated. I mean, you have all of this. These albums are his therapy. Clearly.
Agreed.
So that's what we should celebrate.
Well, X, rest in life.
Very much so.
And we will always remember you, and thank you for your contributions to the music, to the genre, to the culture. And
legend.
You.
Legendary.